Welcome to the Talking Legal Ed podcast with Professors Linda Jellum and Billy Joe Kaufman. In each episode, we explore cutting-edge legal issues with renowned legal scholars and teachers. In these explorations, we discuss the legal doctrines implicated in the issues we tackle. But perhaps more importantly, we look at how legal educators can bring these issues alive in the classroom.
Good morning, Billy Joe. So great to see you today. I'm excited. One of my friends, Wes Oliver, who's a professor at Duquesne Law School, and one of his former students, Morgan Gray, who's currently studying to get a PhD at Pittsburgh, are going to come and talk to us about this idea of creating a course for computer programming for law students.
Linda, I think this is going to be a fascinating conversation with everything going on with ChatGPT. Artificial intelligence has already dipped its toes in the law profession, and I think it's going to continue to do so. So this is going to be fun.
It'll be fun to see how they've brought in something sort of so foreign to most of us and gotten students engaged and interested in taking the course and really thriving in it. I look forward to the conversation. Well, good morning, Wes and Morgan, and it's good to see you, Billy Joe. I am so excited about our discussion today about your new course regarding coding for lawyers. So let's just start briefly, if the two of you, Wes and Morgan, could just briefly explain sort of your backgrounds and what you're currently doing.
Yeah, so I had no background in this really at all. I mean, my first year of college was in the engineering school at UVA, and then I realized I wanted to be a lawyer and kind of transferred to more things that were more social science and history in my studies, and never really looked back in any real way. Went to law school, then practiced criminal defense work in Nashville, Tennessee, and then started teaching criminal law, criminal procedure, evidence, and con law. And it wasn't until very recently that I got into this. So my background in computer science up in the last 2 years really is non-existent.
And Morgan, how about you?
Yeah, so similar to Wes, my background in computer science and artificial intelligence is not that lengthy. I graduated from law school at Duquesne University in 2019. While I was there, Wes and I started working on a research project together focusing on artificial intelligence. And so, you know, it was probably in the spring of 2016 that I started to learn about this, about artificial intelligence and computer science. And eventually, one thing led to another, and now I'm pursuing my doctorate in intelligent systems at the University of Pittsburgh.
Well, that's okay, I'm sorry, Billy Joe, I stepped on you.
Well, I just think it's fascinating because it's almost like accidental future, because I suspect in 2016 you didn't have a PhD in computer science on your schedule.
No, I definitely did not. I had interest in computer science. I had only really taken one formal course in computer science in college. It was you might not even say it was computer science, but it was a statistical course where programming was involved. And I really liked it, and I really enjoyed it. But up until that time, I hadn't taken that any further.
And I'd like to follow up on Billy Joe's accidents of history. Story of this. The way we got started is really quite remarkable. Morgan was a student in my criminal law class, and I was walking to Starbucks one day, and my class had been quite quiet for a few days, and I didn't really know if they were kind of awake out there. And so then Morgan had this really insightful comment in class. And so I'm walking to Starbucks, and I said to him, I see him, and I said, very nice comment in class today. And he said, well, thank you. I said, are you enjoying criminal law? And he goes, well, no, actually, I'm not. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, I studied computer science undergraduate, and which turned out to be one class. And we always had answers there. And you don't seem to be giving us answers. I said, well, you know, welcome to law school. But then I said, wait a minute, you're interested in computer science. Would you come see me? I've got a project that I'm just thinking about getting started with. And he did. And literally this class, his doing the PhD, this project we're working on with for, for policing. And then my attempting to go back and get my master's in computer science online, all this was driven by that one kind of accidental meeting on the sidewalk.
Well, let's talk briefly about that project that you were doing. You were doing a criminal law project and somehow decided that you had to learn coding, which, you know, at this point, I'm afraid we're scaring all of our listeners who are like, oh, my God, no. So why would a law professor or a lawyer, you know, ever decide that he or she needed to learn about computer coding?
Right. So for years, I've taught criminal procedure, and every year I would get to probable cause and reasonable suspicion. And I would always kind of have something I would say, like, I can't tell you what reasonable suspicion or probable cause actually is. I can tell you how to argue about it. I can tell you how to use your lawyerly skills to say something is more or less suspicious. But I can't really tell you what it is. I can't predict for you how a court will analyze this, because it's a multi-factor test, and multi-factor tests just aren't predictable. And then one night I'm watching 60 Minutes, and they're talking about how artificial intelligence is being used to enable medical researchers to look at different strains of research in medicine that researchers otherwise wouldn't be able to connect, because no one could read all the medical journals that are out there, much less draw comparisons among very disparate types of research, unless they had all the time in the world. And I got to thinking, isn't that probable cause? Isn't that, you know, couldn't someone who could read every probable cause decision, if this was possible, start to make these connections and really develop a model for probable cause? And I started talking to people, and how would we go about this? And that's when Morgan encountered me. I'd been talking to a couple of computer scientists about how you could actually build a computational model for suspicion.
So you decide that you need to learn how to do this for your probable cause. You bring Morgan on board, and then the two of you sit down and say, hey, we don't know anything about this yet. Let's go ahead and start a course for lawyers in this and have this at the school. So Morgan, how did you guys move from let's try a project into let's go ahead and teach lawyers something about coding as we teach ourselves?
Yeah. So my personal journey with programming is largely driven by necessity. So in order to complete my research, I have to know how to do it. What we had sort of thought is, you know, outside of doing sophisticated research, this is a skill that would be really useful for law students to at least understand on some level how to do. And it's sort of the idea behind it is, I don't think it's any secret that, you know, technology is really becoming a dominant, perhaps the dominant force in our daily lives. We hear about artificial intelligence all the time, and how, you know, some decisions are being automated. Computer has been programmed to figure this problem out or that problem out. And, you know, I don't think the practice of law is immune to that. Certainly, it's not going to escape it. And there are a lot of times as a lawyer where you would like to know something about this. Perhaps you are working with e-discovery, and if you understand programming, maybe you can take a look at the code that's being used to complete the e-discovery. Maybe you represent somebody or a client where programming is involved. You know, it's really it's a skill that you might not be able to need to do on a daily basis, but we think it's something that, you know, in the future, lawyers definitely should be able to understand at some level if they so desire.
How does this course work? Is it projects? Is it like, how do you get them ready to know enough to code?
Yeah, it's basically an undergraduate class in Python with a lot of legal examples. And so what we do is just like any, you know, any class in computer programming begins, you teach them how to print out hello world. Just because that's the way every one of these starts, and we wanted to have that kind of, you know, that kind of camaraderie with everyone who does computer science. And then after that, we have them design a bunch of code to do a variety of things of increasing difficulty. We tend to do more legal examples for like the homework. And there will be in every single class after the class, there will be a homework assignment. And, you know, the one of the criticisms we got from students was that there was just too much work. And our theory was if you
never
don't
heard
keep
that work, criticism before,
I'm sure you haven't. And they said, you know, maybe if you only had one assignment a week. And you know, this is a type of criticism that I get, but for this class, I don't take in and think we should do anything differently the next time around, because you've just got to keep playing with this stuff if you're going to get it. So each week we would have one individual assignment where, you know, you would do this one on your own, and then a more difficult assignment after the second class that you do as part of a group. And then there was a final project that you did individually, and then there was a final group project.
So can you give me some examples, you know, as somebody who doesn't know anything about Python other than it's a snake I want to avoid? Give me some examples. I show up for your class day one. I'm terrified of math. I don't know why I've decided other than that I like you as a professor and I'm trusting you. And all of a sudden you tell me, okay, you can print out hello world. And I'm like, okay, that's exciting. What's my next thing? What am I going to start learning? Like, what are some of your assignments that the students take, you know, incrementally until they develop this broader range of skills?
So we started out with some basics about computer hardware, you know, how information is stored in the long term, how information is stored in the short term, you know, a very high level working of how, like, what we commonly know as a computer works, how you can give an input, how you can get put out or get output out of it, and just a really high level working of a computer. And, you know, then we introduce the idea that there are all sorts of things that it would be useful where you would say something like, well, if I could just make that automatic, if there's a way that I didn't have to figure that out over and over again, and I could just, you know, punch in a couple numbers, press a button, and out comes my answer. And so the first example that we give, and I think this is characteristic of a lot of programming classes, is just writing a simple program to convert temperature from Fahrenheit to Celsius and from Celsius to Fahrenheit. So you sort of understand how, well, I don't have to work out the math every time. I can come up with this little program where I say Celsius to Fahrenheit, Fahrenheit to Celsius, put in a number, and then out comes your answer. And so we give the students very basic introductions to the sorts of reasons like why you would want to program something, how it can be useful, automating things that might otherwise be monotonous. And then from there, you know, we draw it back a little bit and explain, you know, the basics of the language, the basic syntax of the language, you know, it's sort of like any language that you would speak, read, and write. You know, there's a syntax that you have to understand, you know, and that you have to follow to make the program do something. And so after we give a little example about the kinds of things you would like to do, or, you know, maybe would think about programming, then here's how you go about that.
So let me ask you this question. It sounds like the weekly assignments you all sort of generated with, okay, here, take this set of data, take it from Fahrenheit to Celsius, Celsius back to Fahrenheit, which as I sit here in 14 degree weather, I think, God, I don't want to know what that would be. But what about this final project? You said, Wes, that there was both an individual final project and mm-hmm. then a group project. Did you tell them what to do there, or did they get their choice?
Well, for the individual one, we had one where they would have to, everyone would do the same project where they have to extract a certain amount of data, move it around through all the data structures we created, do some manipulation, put it back into a new data set, and then put it in an Excel spreadsheet. So a lot of the stuff we were teaching them, you know, involved Excel spreadsheets, because that's the way a lot of the world deals with big data, particularly people who are not particularly computer savvy. That's the way they're used to seeing it. But then for the final group project, what we did with that was we said, look, we would ideally like for this to be about something about law. It doesn't have to be, because if you come up with something that's, you know, computationally interesting, that relies on all the stuff that we have taught you, or a lot of it, then we want you to be thinking about how to use computers generally and then see the applications for law later. Our primary goal is to have you understand computers. We figure you can figure out the law part later. But a lot of you will do legal projects, and we think that's actually ideal. So one of our students came up with this wonderful project that took police reports and created a type of natural language processing, a very crude natural language processor that would, and I say crude not because the guy was, you know, rude or nasty or anything, or that it was, you know, it was very sophisticated for someone who'd never seen it before, but, you know, Google would laugh at it. But the key thing is that what this student was doing was using basic knowledge to use to build on, to come up with a way, how would a computer think about using what it can do to figure out what's in a police report, what crime has this police officer described with his or her narrative. Obviously, this has incredible applications for all kinds of things where we have to figure out what a document's talking about. And once he understands how that computer works, he'll probably never then design a full natural language processor or use one, but he'll be able to now talk to people who can build these things and can do these things and work with that person and develop something that can actually identify what's in text.
Do you think that having that skill set will then also make them better writers and even better users of form books and other tools and resources, drafting tools that are being developed for lawyers to use?
Well, they've actually reported to us they feel like they're better writers as a result of thinking this way. And it's actually really interesting to think about form books and horn books and those sorts of things. I almost think that the algorithm is going to be the horn book of the future. And so the better lawyers understand how these systems work, the more we're capable of working with the people who really know what they're talking about when they build them. Our project, we kind of, you know, I was watching this 60 Minutes thing about AI. That's what made me think about our policing project. But I think introducing law students to what computers can do will give them ideas for applications and will make them better able to interface with these folks so that they too can create and discover new applications.
Do you think that with your project with the police reports, you mentioned that you could kind of see what that report was saying. Can you also develop the opposite of what's not being said there?
Yes.
The gaps or the misinformation?
Yeah, I mean, it will depend on what the data looks like. It'll depend on what you're looking to find. It is not there. You know, all kinds of specifics will go into that. But actually, what you're keying into there is, what are the limits and the abilities of computers? Someone who reviewed our class for an award we applied for noted that one of the things we'd done well is we had taught students how to think about what computers were capable of and what they were not capable of. And this is going to be really, really important in a world where things like GPT chat are coming out and are threatening to displace lawyers. We as lawyers and people who are training lawyers need to figure out kind of what's left of the profession and how the profession can use the tools that exist. There are going to be things machines will never be able to do, but we need to know where the ability of the machine ends so we know where to interface with it and best optimize the use of the human who knows law.
I need my computer to figure out how to clean my house and make me dinner. I'll be happy. So Morgan, I have a question for you. It seems like right now all the rage on all of our listservs is ChatGPT, and what is that going to mean for finals, and can the ChatGPT take the bar exam? And, you know, and we're all sitting here like, what is the answer? Do we prohibit students from being able to use it? Or, and I'm going to guess sort of this other way, maybe the way the two of you would go, do we figure out a way to bring in what ChatGPT can do for students in terms of, you know, kind of like we, you know, when we first started math and didn't have calculators, and then they came into being, and at some point the internet came into being. We didn't have that, you know, back when some of us were in law school. So, you know, what do we need to think about in terms of ChatGPT and other AI, Morgan?
Yeah, so I know former versions of GPT were programmed in Python. I think ChatGPT also was as well, but you know, we're certainly not asking our law students to do something that complicated. You know, I'm of the mind that we're not going to get away from it. It's certainly not going to go anywhere. And, you know, I think students and educators should be focused on what skill sets do we need to learn in the age of ChatGPT. So if we can automate writing something, excellent. What skill do you need to do then? Well, you need to focus on comprehension, understanding, and reading. Reading what ChatGPT gives you, comprehending it, making sense of it, verifying it, you know, it's you prompt the model, it will return something, excellent. But the skill that I think needs to be learned by students and perhaps maybe even advocated by educators is that in the age of tools like this, you now have to change your skill set. You need to be able to read the output, make sense of it. Is ChatGPT right? Is it wrong? It's certainly not perfect. I don't think OpenAI would certify that ChatGPT is perfect, although, of course, I don't, you know, speak on their behalf. And so, you know, the idea of being able to prompt the model effectively, I believe there are even jobs opening up where you're a professional prompter, where you prompt models like ChatGPT to give output, you know? So I think it's not shying away from these tools, but really learning how to work with them.
It sort of reminds me of Billy Joe's comment about the forms, right? You know, when maybe initially everyone was like, forms, oh, those are terrible. And yet they're a good starting point. You have to use your legal skills to make them better.
Yeah. And a large part of the papers that I publish, you know, a good chunk of the writing is the error analysis. Where has the AI gone wrong? Where has the machine learning gone wrong? When we ask a model to do something, where has it failed? How can we understand that? And that's really, you know, that's the value of the human way of understanding and thinking. Is there connections that we're able to make that, you know, models certainly are not capable of, at least now.
And you're absolutely right about the form books. Statutes were even seen as an attack on the legal profession because they made the law accessible to people, and therefore, why would lawyers be needed? Lawyers will always be needed, but they're going to need to be even better in a world where computers can do part of your work. In fact, I've introduced GPT chat in my law classrooms. I said, this is why you need to be even smarter, because if the only thing you can do, a computer can also do, you're not needed. So you need to be even smarter in a world where this stuff exists.
I watched just moments of the Murdaugh trial yesterday. Fascinating to somebody who taught some crime once in my life. I'm wondering if it would have applications like to look at a trial transcript, and I don't know what I want it to do, but it just seems like there could be possibilities for trial experts to review testimony overnight or whatever. I don't know what that is, but one of you are going to invent that, or one of your students is. So it just seems like there's a lot of applications.
Yeah,
oh, and no question.
The sort of like techniques that I think you're getting to already exist. You know, I don't know if somebody's doing it with trial transcripts, but classifying information based on text is very popular. A lot of the stuff that Wes and I publish is based on text classification. There are different methods, you know, that you might go about to, and this is really what machines are good at. Taking large amount of text that we can't, you know, and maybe in our wildest dreams, read, comprehend, and understand, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. Doing that, maybe not perfectly, but in a little bit quicker of a way. And again, you look at the output, you decide, is it right? Is it wrong? You know, and you work with the technology.
So let me turn to a different question here, moving back into the class that you guys developed. If I'm not mistaken, Duquesne is a school of about, what, 450? So about 150 per class or so, yeah. So assuming, you know, that's a relatively small school in some situations. What'd you think? You get like 10 people maybe interested in the class? And how many did you get? And how'd you get them in the class?
So I was thinking if we had 4 or 5, I was really afraid that we... I was really hoping that we would get enough that they wouldn't have to dissolve the class. I don't know exactly what the slaughter rule is for Duquesne. I never had to investigate it before, but I was afraid we'd come really close to it and they would have to eliminate the class. And so, you know, I didn't think anything about it when they capped it at 20, because I thought, well, sure, you know, we're not going to get close to that. It won't be any issue. Then I start getting emails. Hey, Professor Oliver, can't get into your class. Can you let me in? Apparently it's capped at 20. I said, yeah, sure. And so, you know, I called the registrar. Can you raise it to 30? I started getting emails. Professor Oliver, I'm on the wait list. Can you help me get in? And I called the registrar at that time. So how many people are on this waiting list? And I think she said about 45. and I said, all right. I went to the associate dean. I said, can we just take the cap off this thing? Can we just open it up? But I knew if we did that, there was something that we needed to do, because at Duquesne, classes under 30 are off the curve. I did not want students who didn't think about doing math and computer coding in law school to think they had to compete for grades over a skill set they hadn't prepared themselves to compete with. And so I was fortunate enough to have the associate dean and the dean back me on this, and we went to the faculty and asked for a variance for our curve. Now, that's something that people have taught at other schools. They've had to go to pass fail to prevent this, because they've also seen the same type of issue with curves. Our school, they just agreed to take it off the curve. And so we ended up with 76 people initially signing up for the class. And as you say, that's basically half one of our entering classes. It dropped back to 68 after the syllabus was released. And then after the first week of class, it dropped back to 57, which is still much, much larger than we were anticipating. But then you know, to bring it back to the grades, one of the really great stories on this, you know, we got plenty of concerns in the final reviews from the students that this was a lot of work and this was really, really hard. But the flip side of that was there were 48 people out of 57 who earned some kind of an A. And I do mean that they earned it. This was not, we weren't just handing these things out. There were people were saying, this is just really the hardest class I've ever taken. But yet you learned how to do it and do it very well. So I was really, really quite impressed with what this class did.
And do you think they enjoyed themselves?
Yeah, Morgan, do you want to tell the story about our students who kind of turned the corner?
Sure. Yeah, so to answer your question directly, I think the super majority definitely enjoyed it and had fun with it. I'm sure that there was a crowd that like really didn't enjoy it at all. And you know, that could have been a number of things, but we had one particular student and like sort of like a group that person went along with, who for the first maybe 3 or 4 weeks like really did, they were sticking through it, but they really did not like it. They did not care for it at all. They were very frustrated, and eventually, you know, they just kept working and working and working, and they ended up being one of the best students in the class. This particular group used methods that were more advanced than what, you know, of course, Wes and I knew about, but more than what we were ever intending on teaching. And they ended up knocking it out of the park, to be frank. And so even despite students who really didn't care for it, maybe for a time, I think a lot of the students ended up at the end really enjoying themselves.
That student sent me an email that said, I just wanted to tell you, I loathed this class for the first 3 weeks, and I couldn't have had any more fun doing the final project. And that, you know, those are the stories that, you know, you just as a teacher, that's why you get into this business.
Well, let's talk about the fact, you know, what the person said was, I absolutely adored the final project, because my experience in teaching law is that we sort of suck all the creativity out of the students in their first few years, in their first year in particular, and in some of our more bigger required classes. And having taught some that are not so big and required, that allow the students to pick, you know, maybe projects where I've had them draft statutes of things they're interested in, or even write seminar papers, when they get the creativity in, they seem to blossom in many ways. Did you have that experience in your class, Wes?
Oh, absolutely. That, in fact, was one of the things that particular student said in her email, that she really loved the creativity of the final project. And what's interesting is, you know, you would think that in a way, even a project that you got to design in, you know, using a computer code to do something wouldn't involve creativity, because it really is, you know, computers are very binary. It either does this or it doesn't, it works or it doesn't. But one of the fascinating things about this class for them, and we told them this, that they would experience this, that with law, when you finish writing a paper, you know, the professor might like it, might not like it. The professor might not like it or not like it because of his or her own, you know, predilections or style or whatever. You will never actually know empirically whether you've done a good job. All you'll know is whether someone liked it or not. With computer coding, when you press that execute button, one of two things happens. Something comes out at the end, or you get an error message. And so there is a type of satisfaction you get out of this thing that you have built. You know if it works or not. And now, what goes into how well it's built, all the kind of stuff you would evaluate normally in a law school paper or an exam, how creative is this? Does it achieve a goal? Does it address a topic? Blah, blah, blah. All those things are true here as well. But there's something about just the mere mechanical fact of you are building something that either does what you built it to do or it doesn't. And when it does, there are very few things that you'll do in your work life that will have as much satisfaction as pressing that button and go, yep, that thing, I can now see it works. And I think that it was the creativity plus it's almost the instant gratification you get from these machines that was something that kind of drove the students.
It seems to me this could be useful in the job search for students, you know, this skill that they can take out. Do you have any experience with that, Wes?
I do. So one of our students did a final project on tax assessments. She looked at Allegheny County tax records, and she was very much the project manager for her group. She led her group to write a code that mined Allegheny County tax assessment records and could determine, based on the algorithm they created, whether a person's taxes were overassessed. And she's working at a law firm that does that kind of work. And so they are going to integrate her work into what the firm does.
Your passion for this, Wes, is just both of you. Now that it was an accidental course, what's next? And what are you going to have to learn to stay ahead of the students?
Well, I think I won't have to learn much to stay ahead of the law students, because very few of them come to law school with this kind of background, though a couple do. And I'll be very honest, we actively discourage them from taking this class. We may even try to figure out some way to prohibit it, because we don't want people in the class. First of all, we're not really qualified to teach people with computer science backgrounds, to be honest with you. But we don't want the people who already know things about this to kind of, you know, make people who don't know it feel inferior. So I actually am working. I'm about to apply for an online master's program in computer science, because I do want to continue learning this stuff. And we're going to just keep. And there's another class I'm going to add to the curriculum as well. And Morgan and I are going to keep working on the policing project. But continuing to learn more about it, I think, really is for my own sake, rather than staying ahead of the students. But I do think I need to stay in touch with the technology to bring that to the students.
Wes, as a law professor who used to teach criminal law, why have you moved into this field? What is it about this particular field that excites you so much?
I think much like what the students are experiencing, I love the fact you press the button and it either works or it doesn't. I personally like the instant gratification. But, I started off as a math guy. You know, I was, you know, on the math team in high school. I started engineering school, and then I discovered I wanted to be a lawyer for a variety of reasons and started studying something completely different. But I've always sort of liked the beauty and the aesthetics of math. And I think the idea now of kind of bringing those two things back together in this, you know, someone described in our class, they said, you know, computer coding is really like if you were to put words and math into one thing, it would be this class. And I think that's just great fun. I think there's all kinds of potential out there for it, but I've really enjoyed nothing as much in teaching as I have this stuff. People used to say to me, you seem like you liked practice. And so why would you get into teaching? I said, well, actually, I prefer teaching. I like the contemplative stuff. I like, you know, the calm of teaching as opposed to practice. But I'll tell you that you'll never have an experience as a law professor like you'll have in court. You know, you'll never come back from a class and say, you know, when I walked into that classroom, I could just, you know, I could smell something in the air. I knew today was going to be the day. And I continued to say that up until this class. When you watch people, I think if I'd become, you know, let's say I'd done a different track with my life and become a math professor. Let's say that had happened. I don't think I would have had this experience because I would have been teaching people who were expecting to learn math. I'm teaching people who are expecting to learn law. And they stumble into this class for whatever reason. And they figure out there's something that they didn't ever think about doing that is really fun, that gives them a sense of satisfaction, and actually can be used to further this career that they have chosen to enter. And to me, that's just a blast.
What I like about it, Wes, too, is you create a role model that it's okay to change paths or directions. Because a lot of law students come in on day one and I'm going to be a tax lawyer. And no matter how much they hate it, they're a tax lawyer.
Right.
And so when they see a faculty member in a classroom, like really doing different things than yesterday, I think that's a great role model.
Thank you.
So, Morgan, how about you? Where are you headed from here?
Well, I'm going to continue pursuing my doctorate at the University of Pittsburgh, which necessitates using Python pretty much every day. And I hope to keep on carrying on the passion for at least getting started understanding programming to law students.
Terrific. Well, thank you, guys. I love to see the passion that you bring. I think we're most successful as law professors or professors in general, when we're teaching something that we're passionate about. And it doesn't always happen where you can just pick up something brand new. I mean, there's so many needs in the law school. So it's wonderful that Duquesne actually was so supportive of this experience. And I assume if anybody who's listening and wants to start their own computer coding class, they can reach out to you at Duquesne West. Wes Oliver at Duquesne, and that you'll be happy to sort of help walk them through the process. One of the things we didn't get into talking about, we're getting kind of tight on time, was sort of the book option that you guys decided to use, sort of the online, the Google, Google Colab that you could sort of edit along the way. So, I mean, maybe that's a discussion for another day, but thanks so much for being on the show, both you guys. It's been a great day and we'll look forward to seeing you around.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. We look forward to speaking with you again in our next episode of Talking Legal Ed.
Talking Legal Ed is produced by David Ritchie in association with Panopticon Media. Editing by Tim Spieshock and artwork by Kaylee Jellum. Please look for all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts.